Good afternoon.
Please be seated. The next two cases on the court's argument calendar is Stephen Tam, M.D. and Alfredo Hebert, P.A. Versus the 8th Judicial District Court and Sherry Cornell and the estate of Charles Thomas Cornell, Jr. and all real parties in interest. Cases 66065 and 66346. I guess we'll hear first from Ms. Jordan and then from Mr. Bedaruddin. Bedaruddin, my apologies. And then you'll have 20 minutes and then we'll hear from Mr. Vogel and again from Mr. Bedaruddin. Okay, ready to go? All right. There's a lot of issues here, so before counsel dive into this, I just want to make an observation that you might spend your best time on your best issues. We are familiar with the facts, so we don't want to hear about the facts. We want to focus entirely on the analytics, on the legal questions that are presented in these writ petitions.
Understood, Your Honor.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Aaron Jordan, and I'm here on behalf of Petitioner Stephen Tam, M.D. I'd like to reserve the last 2 minutes of my time for rebuttal, if it pleases the court.
Mm-hmm.
The issues that are before you here today are brought pursuant to a denial of a motion limine we filed in the district court, asking the respondent to apply NRS 42.021 prior to trial. The respondent denied that motion, and the petition for writ of mandamus is challenging that denial of the motion. The respondent found that NRS 42.021 violated the Equal Protection Clause of the Nevada Constitution and thus denied our motion on that basis. The law in this case has been fully set forth in the papers. Our positions have been fully briefed. The real issue before you, the theme of our arguments, is that the issue today is choice. It's the issue of whether the voters and the legislature have the right to make choices regarding how to handle the conflicting interests in medical malpractice and professional negligence cases. In his written orders attached to the order in our case, the respondent attempted to take away those choices and required firm evidence supporting the voters' and legislators' choices, without which he would deem those choices irrational and unconstitutional. With this, I maintain the respondent changed the entire structure of constitutional analysis as it is in Nevada. The people of Nevada chose to enact NRS 42.
Well, in the papers below or in any of the arguments that were made below, was there any testimony, any affidavits that would suggest that the district court's recitation, that there's no evidence of this or that, was in any way supported in the record?
Was there any evidence supporting the standard of review?
Well, in connection with his observation, there was no evidence that doctors were leaving the state. There was no evidence that it was going to reduce health care costs. There was no evidence it would change health insurance premiums, return those reduction in premiums to the physicians. Was that supported by any information, any evidence in the record to support the judge's assertions?
It was not, Your Honor, and there were references made to decisions in other cases in other jurisdictions that have discussed this issue at length with supporting evidence. But in this case, whether or not there's supporting evidence for the legislation is not at issue. What is at issue is the power.
It appeared that the district court judge's order was second-guessing the determinations by the legislature and the people on those questions. So I just want to know if there's any evidence in the record that provided a basis for him to do so.
There is not. In fact, All he cited was that there is no firm evidence. There is no evidence. That was the theme throughout his case. And I cited in the papers where he goes through no firm evidence of X, no firm evidence of Y, no firm evidence of Z. It wasn't an examination of there's evidence that says that it doesn't work, there's evidence that says that it does work. It was simply, I don't have any evidence before me that it does work. And I maintain that would be an improper analysis to for the district court to make or to make at this point in the proceedings. As the standard to evaluate a statute that is part of medical malpractice reform that does not involve a fundamental right or a suspect classification is rational basis. When you use rational basis, there's a presumption that the legislature acted rationally and that the statute has a rational basis.
Well, why should we hear this case? Why don't you just, why don't we just deny it and have you go to the legislature? It seems like the defense bar has done a pretty good job with construction defect and tort reform. And why are we hearing this?
We're hearing this because this is a statute that has been enacted for the protection of all health care providers in the state of Nevada.
Well, it sounds like it's not clear to at least one judge.
That's true.
And you've got time. The legislature's in session. We go every once in a while and visit. And like I said, the defense bar has done this already. We could deny this today. There's been no verdict. There's been no trial. There's been no a possibility of a settlement. I understand over 90% of the cases settle anyway. So why are we hearing this? Why don't you go to the legislature and clear this up?
This isn't an issue that needs to be cleared up in the legislature. This is a statute that is binding in effect in Nevada. This is a statute that needs to be applied by the district court as it is in effect as a protection for the health care providers in Nevada, negligent and non-negligent alike. There's nothing for the legislature to do at this point. It's our position that the statute is enforceable and should be enforced and used in the district court proceedings for medical malpractice cases.
You're saying there's no ambiguity in the statute and it's clear on its face?
It's clear on its face as to the issues that are brought up with this particular case before.
Now, the only question I had is as it applies to medical malpractice and professional negligence, which is your argument is subsumed into professional negligence is subsumed into medical malpractice.
Yes, I am.
Or the other way around.
I am arguing our position is that medical malpractice is part of professional negligence. In other words, professional negligence is broader than and inclusive of medical malpractice, and here's why. That it's because of the definitions in the Chapter 41A for medical malpractice statutes. The definition of medical malpractice says that it's a negligence action against certain providers, including physicians such as Dr. Tam. Professional negligence states that it's a negligence action against providers of health care. And then the definition of providers of health care includes the entities that are in the definition for medical
including
malpractice.
Including physicians.
Including physicians such as
correct.
Dr. Tam.
So how did the district court reconcile that that aspect?
He didn't. The district court took the decision in Egan in the language in which it says that the court's decision clearly had conflated the two. The Fairley decision had conflated medical malpractice and professional negligence. The district court interpreted that to mean that they were mutually exclusive and could not coexist. But rather, what I believe the Egan decision said was that medical malpractice applies, if a statute says it applies to medical malpractice, you cannot apply it to professional negligence. But the reverse is not true, and in fact cannot be true if you look at the details of the definitions in Chapter 41A.
So your point is medical negligence is a subset of professional, medical malpractice is a subset of professional negligence.
Yes, because it includes actions against the providers for medical malpractice. So professional negligence is broader. Medical malpractice is a more narrow category, but it's also professional negligence. So a medical malpractice action is both a medical malpractice action and an action for professional negligence at the same time.
Well, Justice Cherry asked why review this. The district court judge appears to have arrived at his conclusions in these orders using intermediate scrutiny rather than rational basis throughout. Could you comment on why that was error from your perspective?
Yes, I would be happy to. In fact, the respondent did state that he was using an intermediate type of scrutiny derived from the Lekanen case. And that is based upon one word in the Lekanen case, substantial and rational relationship. It's our position that that's not actually what intermediate scrutiny is or when it is called for, and that this court did not adopt a new standard with Lekanen because that standard was not restated in the case of Tarango, which was 26 years later. But it was error for the respondent to apply a standard of review higher than rational basis, because this is a case that does not involve fundamental rights or suspect classifications. It's an economic statute.
And it appears that Judge Weiss acknowledged that.
That's right. And in fact, his opinion was somewhat confusing, because at one point he stated that he believed this court would apply rational basis to this challenge to the statute, but then went on to say that a higher level of scrutiny would be what he was applying. But rational basis is appropriate. If you look at the Barrett case, which is key to many of our arguments, the Barrett case has already stated that medical malpractice reform statutes in Nevada are reviewed using a rational basis standard, the highly deferential standard of review. So I believe that issue's already been decided.
Okay. The rest of your time will be reserved.
Thank you.
Mr. Baradine?
It's Butterudine, Your Honor.
Butterudine.
For your attempt.
I'm sorry.
I wanted to mention something that doesn't come up often in the pleadings, and that is the statute was passed by voter initiative, which I know is obvious, but with a voter initiative, there's a lot of discussion in some of the case law that we don't second-guess the legislature, and the legislature goes through a lot of trouble to investigate these matters and draw some lines and balance some interests, but the voters don't have the luxury of doing that, the committees to do that, the resources to do that. All they have is what was filed. It was filed in it's the condensation and the summary of the statute, and it was filed, it was before the judge, and that would be his evidence of what the basis was for the voters passing this initiative and what evidence there was when the voters determined that there's a crisis and that this crisis can be dealt with this statute.
So you're saying we should adopt a different standard of review on rational basis depending on whether a statute is initiative passed as opposed to legislatively passed?
Well, with the cases that deal with legislative enacted statutes, the court doesn't like to second guess the legislature's findings.
And you're saying we should second guess the voters?
No, I'm saying that you can easily look at the condensation and see what the voters were considering, what evidence they had.
Well, counsel, it's a situation we are kind of stuck with the will of the people, unless you can ferret out why, as the argument's being raised, this is in fact unconstitutional, a violation of equal protection. Why is it a violation of equal protection?
I think ultimately because in looking at the condensation and the information that's in the summary, there's no evidence that one was going to affect the other. There's no evidence that this abrogating the collateral source rule for the benefit of medical malpractice defendants was going to reduce insurance premiums.
At this from strict scrutiny? We're looking at this rational basis?
I was looking at it with rational basis. And in fairness, it's kind of confusing which standard to use. Judge Weiss went through some lengthy explanation of which standard he thought, and I read his standard as being yet a fourth standard, somewhere between intermediate scrutiny and strict scrutiny. Or maybe it's between rational basis and strict scrutiny. But
we start with a perception that the statute is valid, as counsel pointed out, so how do you then assert the challenge you're making on behalf?
Well, it's not as if the courts never challenge the legislature's finding that there's no relationship between the statute and the purpose. Many courts have said, this just isn't so. I was reading the condensation earlier, and it says, doctors are coming to Nevada. We're licensing more than ever. There was no crisis to deal with, according to, some of the allegations in the summary and condensation. But going back to your comment, Your Honor, I think the best argument is vagueness. The statute is very, very vague, such that it's going to result in arbitrary and different enforcement for a variety of reasons. To whom does it apply? you know, does it our case started out with claims against health care providers and non-health care providers, and we've since gotten rid of the non-health care providers. But this statute will come up in a variety of circumstances, primarily medical products liability, where there are people, entities who are covered by the statute and entities who are not. So what to do then? And it's going to be left up to the trial judge, whatever they feel they should do. It's going to depend on the theory. There's cases where, in this case, our claim was dismissed, but we asserted an elder abuse claim. And would, if the elder abuse claim had survived, would the statute have applied to the claims made against the health care providers for elder abuse, but not professional negligence? When to allow the evidence? How about post-verdict? That would work for me, but that's not what the statute says, and I think I could convince some judges to do it that way and not so successful with other judges. And then premium payments. I've been paying health insurance premiums my whole life, not in anticipation of an injury that's going to occur, but to safeguard myself in the event an injury does occur. So do I start with a lifetime of payments, 1 month of payments, or something in between? And then there's another problem when health insurance premiums are taken as employment benefits. What then? And it's gonna vary from judge to district to state and federal court. It's going to vary. It's going to be discriminatory and arbitrary. So I think the biggest problem with the statute is its vagueness. I think this plain means I'm out of time.
Not really. You've got some additional time remaining. but I wanted to question you about this vagueness allegation. My understanding of the vagueness determination by the judge was his concern that the vagueness dealt with whether this was only covered professional negligence or medical malpractice, and that there was a difference between the two, and he treated them as mutually exclusive. I don't recall any other vagueness identifications that he pointed out.
I don't believe the trial judge, Judge Weiss, made a distinction with regard to anything other than professional negligence and medical
negligence. So my point is, what's in front of the court and the subject of this writ is whether his determination that the statute was unconstitutional for vagueness reasons is focused on this distinction about whether the statute covers medical malpractice. Perhaps you could respond to your opponent's argument that medical malpractice is in effect a subset of professional negligence because of the way the statute is worded.
I would say that the statute, it doesn't say that. It doesn't say med-mal is a subset of professional negligence. And in the brief, they don't cite any case or statute that suggests that the two are, I think, of a Venn diagram. One is subsumed in the other. It kind of sounds like Webster's Dictionary is the basis for the assertion that medical malpractice is a subset of professional negligence. But they're each defined by different statutes, and we could go through a variety of statutory causes of action or common law causes of action that are defined in the law that appear to be subsumed one in the other. For example, negligence. Is negligence a category of medical malpractice? It seems to have most of the same.
Well, isn't this inquiry far more focused than where you're going with this? Under 42.20211, it talks about a provider of health care based upon professional negligence. And then it goes into 42.0218C, a provider of health care includes a physician licensed under Chapter 630 or 633 of NRS. Where is the big disparity in finding that medical malpractice is subsumed within professional negligence based upon those two statutes?
I don't understand what you mean by disparity.
Well, you're saying it's a leap to find that, or it's vague, in the sense that medical malpractice doesn't belong within the definition of professional negligence.
Well, one could determine, or this court could determine, that one is subsumed in the other. But early on in the lawsuit, they were going to dismiss our claim, not because it was a professional negligence claim, but because it was a medical malpractice claim. We had to attach an affidavit of merit as required by the statute. And the court said, well, your affidavit of merit is adequate. But there was never any mention of, well, how about we just go forward on the professional negligence claim? We should have been able to do that. But I don't think it was possible because we were clearly pursuing medical malpractice.
I have a question going back to your original argument. What standard of review do you contend should be used? Do you agree that it should be rational basis?
I think it should be rational basis because most courts employ rational basis.
Okay.
I don't know that my opinion is important in that regard. But
well, it is. I mean, what are you contending for? I'm not really just asking for your opinion, but you would acknowledge that the correct standard of review is rational basis. That seems to be what the cases say.
Yes, ma'am, and I think there's quite a bit of case law to support such a determination.
Okay. And under rational basis review, you would not get into outside evidence of whether a statute is achieving the declared purposes, would you?
I think you would. There has to be some basis for determining whether the statute's going to achieve its legitimate purpose or not.
Okay. So that's your position on rational basis on this statute?
Yes, ma'am. And it's conveniently located in the condensation summary.
Okay. The second bell, Mr. Badarudin, did I pronounce your name correctly that
you
time?
You did, sir. Thank
I'm
you.
I'm getting closer anyway. I'll have another opportunity to try that again. Thank you for your argument. Ms. Jordan, you have a minute 30.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to make a couple of points in response to my colleague's arguments. The first point that Mr. Badarudin set before this court was that the voters don't have the same resources as the legislature when voting on statutes, and that this should be considered when evaluating the statute. My response to that is that this statute was enacted in 2004, and the legislature has had the opportunity to amend that statute if it wanted to, or at least attempt to, and that statute has not been amended since it was enacted by the voters. Secondly, Mr. Badarudin pointed out that there, in his opinion, there's no evidence that this statute would reduce insurance premiums. This goes to the question that you just asked. I don't believe that this is the place for determining whether there's any evidence, because it has already been determined that medical malpractice statutes in Nevada are evaluated using rational basis when there's an equal protection challenge. And regarding the vagueness argument, this is an evidentiary statute, just like other statutes that don't give details for how the evidence is to be admitted, but leave that to the court, such as 41035. Lastly, there's no constitutional right to damages in Nevada, and this statute doesn't affect any plaintiff's right to be able to bring an action before the court. What it does do is offer additional protections to medical professionals working in Nevada, both the negligent ones and the non-negligent ones. The protections are for all of them. This reduces verdicts and malpractice premiums and encourages medical professionals to practice medicine in Nevada. At the same time, it allows plaintiffs who are genuinely injured to bring claims. These are legitimate state interests, and the statute is rationally related to them.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
All right, we'll move to the next case,